This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. I think that it is one of the leading horror t-shirt and sock companies that I go to.
I would definitely agree with
I
that.
I think so.
They also have really good enamel pins.
They got great enamel pins. They're focused on creating original artwork commissioned from top artists on the highest quality printing on super soft ring spun cotton shirts. And you guys know I need some soft, soft tees on this body.
Ryan's got sensitive skin.
I do.
Does that explain the tight shirt?
They featured many licensed properties. Pretty much if you can think of a horror film, they have it. I bought my Rawhead Rex shirt there.
There's a Rawhead Rex shirt?
I have a Rawhead Rex shirt.
Damn, right, 2017 right. is the year of the Rex.
I also have a brain damage shirt from there. I think that some of these have been retired by now, but you can always go and sometimes you can vote and
request
they'll bring back some of the retired artworks.
And so they cover more than just shirts. They cover socks and lounge pants, like the little horror sticker lounge pants that I wear.
And they just did a line of novelty masks, like Ben Cooper style novelty masks that are really cool.
Now, upcoming titles that they're working on right now is Evil Dead 2.
Which has just been released.
Oh, has it?
Yeah,
oh,
on
crap.
August 23rd, which will have happened by the time this show airs.
Yeah.
So therefore, you need to rush to Fright Rags and pick up your Evil Dead 2 merch.
And you can use the,
Hellraiser 3.
Hellraiser 3 just
dropped those.
Recording day today.
Yeah.
Do they have one that has CD Man on it?
There's a t-shirt that has Pinhead at the top and all of the people, including CD Man.
Damn straight, Skippy. Okay, cool. I need this.
So head to fright-rags.com, discount code SHOCKWAVES0817. Again, that's SHOCKWAVES0817. And that'll remain active until 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. September 30th.
Shockwaves 0817. Head there and get a sweet discount.
And the Frankenberry socks are currently on sale, down to $7.80.
Yes.
Boom.
Why do I not have Frankenberry socks, guys?
How awesome is that?
Those are really cool.
I got Booberry socks. Welcome to episode 62. I'm your co-host, Ryan Turek.
What's up?
Across from me is Mr. Rob Galuzzo.
It's me.
Over to my right is Mr. Kane. Elric Kane.
Thanks for the phantom carriage.
Within arm's reach, I've got Rebecca McKendry.
We're all
together again.
The whole team. Voltron unites.
Phantom Carriage supplied us with some brews tonight.
Nice. Drinking it.
I don't know if they knew that, but I swung by on Sunday and picked up a few things.
We are drinking, I'm drinking a Diet Coke at the moment, but we also.
we're drinking the booze.
I'm a wild woman. We have the Crawling Eye and something called Broad Acres.
Broad Acres, wild Berliner wise.
They smell very apple-y.
They're really good.
Yeah.
Just for you listeners out there, don't forget to swing by our social media accounts on Twitter at Shockwaves Pod, Facebook Shockwaves Podcast, and Instagram Shockwaves Podcast. Give us a follow, a like, throw some comments up on there, and be sure to swing by iTunes, and leave a review or a star rating. It'd be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, and feel free to tag us. People have been already doing this, but it's fun to see people tag us when they buy or are watching films that we talked about, like I call him BK because I feel uncomfortable saying bloody C-word on the air.
Yeah,
but hey, BK posted this great shot of the Zodiac Killer Blu-ray from last week's episode with a beer right next to it,
nice.
And like his night's all sorted.
I
love seeing stuff like that.
BK, I got a push through notification that he had tagged me in a tweet one time when I was having lunch with my mom, and she looks down and she was like, "What's that?" And I was like, "Oh, it's a note from one of my friends," and she goes, "Your friend has a very saucy name." Saucy name. But I have had so many conversations on Escape from the Bronx on Twitter and Facebook this week last episode.
Oh,
And someone agrees with me that he has that very lovely body, arms, a lot of trash? Arms there. Yeah, trash.
About trash?
He's got a lot of arms.
I still haven't seen that.
No. Well, that will fit into our exploitation topic, because now it's just us to talk about it this time.
Yeah.
But let's catch up on the four of us haven't been together for a while, so let's catch up on what we've seen.
Yeah.
Who wants to go first?
And where Ryan was. I don't even know.
Oh, yeah.
Where were you last time? Do you remember?
Where was I?
God knows. Maybe you're in Toronto or somewhere.
Oh, I was on set.
Okay.
Yeah, we were finishing up a film called Only You, directed by Jacob Estes, starring David Oyelowo and Storm Reid.
I also recall a movie with Robert Downey Jr. called Only You from many, many movies.
This is true.
Ryan's working on that. They were on set for it again.
Very, very aware of that.
Almost a supernatural angle to it. He was reincarnated, I think.
Yeah. But now that I'm out, chances are.
Is it?
No, it's Only You.
Oh, Only You.
Yeah.
There might be a couple movies with the same 80s plotline.
Every once in a while.
Robert Downey Jr. Yeah.
Speaking of conversations on Twitter, so last week I had said something to the extent of that I used to go to the drive-in near my house and they would always play double features and you would go see like some awesome badass exploitation film and then they'd follow it with something like Hope Floats. Somebody messaged me on Twitter that Hope Floats is a really good movie and I should not be ragging on it.
Wow.
So at some point.
Hope Floats?
Yeah, with Sandra Bullock.
Harry Connick Jr.? Forrest Whitaker directed, I believe.
I might have seen Hope Floats and Forces of Nature as a double feature.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh,
see,
man.
I very much remember that there was some really good, like, kick-ass horror movie playing at the drive-in before Hope Floats. And then I tried to stay for the Hope Floats, and I made it through, like, the first 10 minutes where she's having a conversation with her daughter about how she used to be this beauty queen, and she was, like, the queen of corn, and her daughter kept saying, you were the cream of corn, and then I drove out.
So just so you guys know, Exploitation Month has been detoured into a romantic drama.
So no, Sandra Bullock movies, guys. Does everyone have their list ready?
No. This is a horror podcast, believe it or not. You did not accidentally hit the wrong thing. So.
Has she ever been in a horror film? I don't think she has.
Sandra Bullock?
Yeah, I'm sure she's done at least
one. I can't think of one.
Do we consider
that would have been all over that.
She did that witch movie, guys.
Practical Magic?
Do we consider that a horror film?
Not horror. No.
She did that one where she's getting letters from somebody of another time period. It was like letters in a mailbox.
All right, I'm calling it now. Becca, me and you, side podcast, Sandra Bullock. Ryan,
no, I want in on that. Because I remember, what was the one with, not Forces of Nature, what was the one, it came out, I saw In the Mouth of Madness, and then I hopped over to a Sandra Bullock movie.
Okay, guys, I swear, okay. She had to have done, I'm going to find a horror.
Right. So,
give me 5 minutes.
Right. Rob, you want to go first?
Yeah, you know what, I will start with the surprise movie that I saw this week. Last night in Los Angeles, actually it'll be a couple days when this airs, there was a 10th anniversary event for Hatchet, which came out 10 years ago. I can't believe that. Mm. And, you know, we've been friends with Green for a long time. Mm. And I remember very distinctly, I wasn't even living here yet. I remember going to see Hatchet several times at the one theater in New York City that was shown. And I kept just bringing friends because I was like, this is such a blast. It's so much fun. And at least in New York, the Hofstra joke always got a huge laugh. So that was always fun.
Yeah.
But I've always been a big fan of the first movie and I like the subsequent ones. And I love Spiral, which was the movie he did kind of at the same time with Joel David Moore.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a fan of Green. I like Green a lot. And last night was advertised as like a 10th anniversary event where all the casts from all three movies were going to be there. And I think everybody was expecting it just to be a screening of the original movie again. And I got to tell you, it was really cool because first of all, seeing all those familiar faces, not just from the movies, but like obviously like I got to sit with Brian Collins and a lot of our friends that we've all known for the last 10 years. And half of the theater is that and the other half are people that waited that actually are huge Hatchet fans to see this for free. And I was sitting kind of up towards the back and Adam came out and did a very heartfelt introduction about why he even bothered to make yet another Hatchet movie. And actually it was really sweet. Basically the super short version story, because I'm sure he's going to go on tour and tell it. And I don't want to take away from that. But a lot of it had to do with the fact that we are now of that age where we're losing our heroes. You know, Wes Craven died, he's gone. And that's like one of the guys that's pretty pivotal for why we're all in this room right now.
Yeah.
And the other one was George, which he was saying he had moderated a panel with George a few months ago at like a Rock and Shock. Mm-hmm. And that afterwards, basically, George was like, when are you going to make another one of those Hatchet movies? And, and he's like, I'm not doing that anymore. And he's like, why not? He's like, that's what they want, pointing to the audience. He's like, that's what you're known for. You gotta embrace it, which is basically what George does.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said the night that George said that to him, he went home and started writing what became Hatchet 4, aka Victor Crowley, which is the actual title. And that is what he showed last night. And it was really cool because when he announced it, he's like, I made this new movie and that's what I'm going to show you tonight. The half of the audience that, well, the whole audience was into it, but the half that was there thinking they were going to see Hatchet was like completely blindsided and like losing their minds and going on Facebook Live and stuff. So that was really, it was really kind of heartwarming to see that.
I wonder how he kept that secret. That's amazing.
It was holding
on.
There were rumors floating around. But
somebody I remember going on Twitter once, and I mean, like, it doesn't matter now, but I remember going on Twitter and someone was like, yeah, so I just passed by a door that had a sign that said Hatchet 4 Accounting on it. And then I went back like 5 minutes later and it was gone. And I think Adam got to him and was just like, dude, come on now. Come on.
Yeah. Wow.
But no, it was, you know what? It was worth it to see it that way last night. And as far as the movie goes, I don't want to talk too much about it because I think it is really fun to be surprised by both the familiar faces that are in it, kind of the callbacks to the other movies and kind of what he does in it. It's a lot of fun. I mean, part of it helps that Brian Collins' infamous cackle was next to me the whole time.
the Brian Collins cackle.
Laughing at all the right spots as if the jokes were made just for him. But it was a blast. It was, if I had to compare it to any of the other movies, it was very much spiritually in tone with the first one. It just literally felt like
back to the basics.
I was a little nervous because rumors I'd heard over the years was that I think somebody asked him once about Hatchet 4 years ago and he said something about it being sort of a meta approach at like a convention or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I was like kind of nervous that that's what it was going to be. But basically when it opened in a very similar fashion to the first Hatchet, it's just like, oh, this is just going to be another movie like that. And it's cool, very gory, very angry because I think it's safe to say he had a divorce in the time period that he made his last movie. And it's very evident in a lot of the dialogue and gags because the two of the characters are divorced in the movie itself.
Does the dog make an appearance, Arvin?
But Arwen's name is definitely.
Arwen, okay.
Arwen's name is definitely represented in it. And the one cast member I'll tell you because he's kind of the lead is Chase Williamson from John Dies.
Who I can say this now. So while we were shooting, because Chase is one of the leads in my movie, we were supposed to shoot one particular day and he was like, I can't be there because I'm shooting not an Adam Green movie. And I said, what? And he goes, it's definitely not an Adam Green movie, but I have another shoot that day. So can we possibly do another day? And so I rearranged around it, but he was shooting not an Adam Green movie at the time. So,
right. Well, I had a blast with it. I think if you like those movies, especially the first one, if you had a blast with the first one, I think you're really going to enjoy this one a lot. If you don't like the Hatchet movies, you're not going to like this. Like if none of them won you over, but this is a lot of fun, great kills. Kane's amazing in it.
Does it look like a similar budget or does it look lower budget?
You know what's funny? I assume it's lower budget, but there's some pretty ambitious shit that was done in it that was really impressive. And there's one thing specifically, but I don't want to give it away because it's such a big portion of what the main set is for the majority of the movie. But it's really well executed considering that it's a low budget movie. And you're going to be really pleasantly surprised with several of the cast members, all of which have been on the show.
nice.
So that was a lot of fun, and it was just a great night. And I think it's super cool the way he's doing it because now it'll be at Fright Fest next week, and I believe he's just going to do like a 25-city tour and just show it this way. Like, just get fans together and screen it for him and then talk about it after. And
cool.
I think it was super cool.
I was taking the Kevin Smith approach to distribution.
And you know what? Why not? If that works, then just bring it straight to the audience that wants to see it. And so, I'm really proud and happy for Adam. And I hope this gets him back to where he wants to be. So, loved it. Can't wait for you guys to see it.
Cool.
Yeah. All right.
I saw a show. I don't know if anyone's been watching. I won't go into detail about, but I know we mentioned Room 104, the HBO show. I'm up to date on those. I recommend them to people.
I've been
it's a little offbeat.
Them.
It's not necessarily, so far they haven't been that horrorish.
I'd say
they're almost, you know, Twilight Zone, but more sexualized.
Twilight Zone-y. Like the first one, I was okay with, but I wasn't blown away by. And so I had problems. Like it took me a while to proceed, but I like 2 and 3 a lot.
I've liked all of them to an extent. I like them because they don't outstay their welcome. It's 26 minutes.
Yeah, they're
and it's
quick.
Just a fun, quick. I thought the one with Dawson was great. What's
James
his name?
Vanderbeek.
Vanderbeek.
James
I thought the twist of that
yeah,
was really
that was
fun.
Number two. I really liked that one.
But that's just, I think if you haven't checked out, worth checking out because we don't have any shows like that are that
what's
short.
What's it called again?
Room 104.
Room 104, that's on HBO.
Yeah, and it timed it nice because I would have never gotten my HBO subscription for that. I just would have waited it for it to come around. But since it's also Game of Thrones, I had my kind of few months of my HBO subscription
going
on.
Which at some point when that all wraps and everyone's seen it, we've got to talk about it from a horror perspective because some of the horror stuff in Game of Thrones is really
this week in particular.
The zombies are so much better than any other zombies.
Someone blew it for me on Instagram.
Damn.
But I mean, I'm a season behind, but I saw that and I actually shed a tear.
Trust me, they didn't blow it for you.
No, I know.
Nothing will compare to
the things that matter to me. In that episode, I was like, oh.
Yeah, no, it's really.
It's amazing.
I'm always cinema before TV. No matter how good TV gets, I still am always cinema. This is as close as I've ever gotten to where that line's really blurred. I'm like, I could be watching this in a theater every week. It's that good and that big, and the scale is just pretty remarkable. But I watched a movie I think you already saw it a little way back, The Transfiguration.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Now it's on the Netflix.
Q&A'd
no,
the screening.
Oh, I thought you had recommended it.
I saw the similar one called Aaron's Blood.
Yeah. Funny. I thought you had gone to that screening.
No, I did because I moderated the panel at it and interviewed the director.
This was definitely one of those. Hang on a second. Let me just preface this. This is one of those movies that I saw and was like, this is an Elric movie?
Uh-huh.
Is it?
You know what's funny? On paper, 100%, right? Because like it even mentions Martin in it. Martin's one of my favorite movies. The only thing about it, I had just seen a movie I highly recommend, not horror, but The Safdie Brothers' Good Time with Robert Pattinson. Dude,
I need to watch that this weekend.
And what it has is this like pulse to it. Like every scene is throbbing with excitement and the soundtrack. And this film, the one thing I didn't like about it is flat. It's like each scene bleeds into the next. And it's cool because it's got this realism going. But at no point, even in a murder sequence, let's say, the rhythm doesn't really change.
It doesn't feel like a climax.
No,
you can't tell where the act breaks are. It feels constant. And it feels really long in that regard.
In that sense, it is. It's only 95 minutes. It's on Netflix now. The performances are great. Larry Fessenden's very briefly in it. I think Lloyd Kaufman gets killed and maybe in the back.
Yep.
There's a couple just really quiet cameos. You wouldn't even really know it's Larry because it's the back. I mean, we would. Anyone who listens to this would because it's the back of his head and the side of his face. But it's a New York horror film. It's one of those horror films I think will be more interesting on a level of you would study it for the book on vampire stuff because it's like smart. But in terms of rewatchability, you know, you probably would never rewatch it.
That's a good,
You know, but I think everyone listening to this will definitely want to check it out because it's definitely part of that canon of films. I thought it was interesting, but I guess I'm at a point now where even if a film is like an hour, I want to be like moved a little more. Mm-hmm. I want something that like just takes me away a little more. So I felt myself very aware of watching a procedural vampire film that somebody had planned meticulously versus this is just a great story.
Right.
My issue with it was that it felt like, and you may have liked this because that sounds more like an Elric film, that it felt like it threw every social issue they could find up on the board.
I don't really like
lots
of social.
Let's get some race.
I like
a PTSD.
Little.
Okay, rape victim, child abuse, drinking problems. And it was just, it was all in there to the point where I was like, it seemed
gang
like it was
culture
gang culture. Yeah. And because there was so much in there. And
yet that makes it sound cliche and it's really not. They do it in such a minimal way that, but I agree with you. I do think they're throwing too much
in there. Oh, and suicide. There was some suicide stuff in there too.
Look, if you go to Letterboxd, I mean, there are a lot of critics who I really like on Letterboxd who are giving this thing 5 stars out of 5 or 4.5. So it's been really well received, but I guess it's like one of those critic darlings rather than being like Annabelle 2. I enjoyed the fuck out. Like I sat in a theater and was taken somewhere.
So I hear.
You know, oh yeah, you heard that, right? but no, I really, and there is a difference. I don't always want that feeling, but I really liked it, So it's definitely a must watch, but I don't think it would necessarily make my top 10 at the end of this year. It might just be outside that bubble.
Nice. All right.
So I watched I Bury the Living from 1958 because, somebody just did a fancy schmance release. Was it Scream Factory?
I don't think so.
I might have been Synapse.
Somebody look that up while I talk about
Albert
it.
Albert Band, right?
Somebody, yes. Yeah, the reason I watched it was I had just received a new release copy of it. So somebody did. But anyway, it's just recently been released to Blue. So I Bury the Living, this is 1958, directed by Albert Band. So this is Charlie Band's dad. Which is how Charlie grew up in the industry and everything. I have always loved this movie. I haven't seen it in probably the last decade. It is about a guy who is hired as a cemetery director, and he quickly discovers so they plot out the cemetery by they have this giant board, and when people buy grave plots, they put a white pin in. And then if somebody is actually buried in the grave, they put a black pin in. And as they're rearranging a couple of plots, they're moving some pins around. And so wherever Mrs. Henderson was, even though that she's still alive, you know what? We're going to put Mr. Griffiths there, and he's already dead. So then they'll put a black pin there, rearranging. And whoever they move and put a black pin in their place, that person dies. Mrs. Henderson suddenly kicks it. And so this happens a couple times, and the funeral director becomes really paranoid, thinking that he's doing it. And even though that the movie still is kind of ambiguous and you don't know what's going on for most of it, it has so much tension. And it's not even just the, is it real? Is he really causing these people to die? It is crafty. I mean, like the craft of filmmaking behind it. It's one of those films where I feel like it was probably made for a pittance, and it was supposed to be kind of a quick and dirty exploitation-y thing to push out to drive-ins. But man, I didn't even realize, because I'd seen this film before, but watching it now on my TV, that throughout the course of the film, the board that they're actually using to put the pins in, it gets larger. And so whereas it's subtle and it happens scene by scene. So in the first scene, you know, there's room on either side. And then throughout the course of the film, it gradually gets larger, so that by the end, he's standing in front of it, and it's like the fucking size of the wall.
Oh,
and
God.
It's so effective. So it's like it's literally like overwhelming him by the end. Really cool cinematography too. So yeah, I love this one. Highly recommend checking it out. Stephen King has written about this book a few times, or this movie a few times, and even based one of his short stories, Obit, off of it.
Mm-hmm. And so, Shout Factory did release it.
Shout Factory was Scream Factory. Yeah. So yeah, it's like a Hitchcockian level of tension throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, it almost could have been a Hitchcock Presents. It almost has that vibe.
It really does have that vibe.
We saw it at the, it was part of the 24-hour New Bev, I guess last Halloween or the one before. And it had that spot where usually you might fall asleep. I think they do that around 2. Mm-hmm. And it's always a black and white old film. And so I was like, is that going to be the part where I'm done? And it was, everyone was totally in.
It's
like,
great.
It really kept there. I'd never heard of it at that point when I saw it, and I loved it. It was a really great little thriller.
I Bury the Living.
Yeah, this is one. I remember my parents had a VHS copy, and for like most teens, I went through my like, I refused to watch anything in black and white phase. And then I eventually watched it one day, probably around age 17, and was just like, dude, this is really good. And so, yeah, I was really happy to revisit it, and it still holds up just as well as I remember.
Nice.
Cool.
My selection for this week, Wheels of Terror. It's a 1991 made-for-TV movie. Let me just preface this by saying that in creating a Slashback video, which opens September 9th here in Burbank, California at the Mystic Museum, I'm collecting and buying a lot of VHS tapes and a lot of titles I have never heard of or seen before. So Wheels of Terror came across my desk, and I was like, wow, that's a souped-up muscle car. Cool, check that box. Does its headlights look evil? Yep. Check that box. Is it a car ripoff? You betcha. And so this one was written by Alan B. McElroy of Halloween 4 fame and the writer of Spawn. The movie Spawn, not the comic book. Huh. And Joanna Cassidy of Blade Runner is the lead. Yeah. And her and her daughter basically are Los Angeles transplants who move to a dusty old town, and Joanna Cassidy takes on a bus driver job. And do you think that she's going to take on this car with her bus? You damn right.
Oh, wow. All right.
Does this bus feature a souped up engine? Fucking A, it does. Will she take on the car? Oh, yeah. So basically what happens in the film is that this car rolls into town and basically starts preying upon little girls. It's really kind of...
This is like Pedicar.
It is.
Well, there's your exploitation movie. Yeah, Pedicar.
Most
hashtag
definitely
Pedicar.
Pedicar. It is very much a pedo car in the sense that it just rolls through town, kind of creeps up on unsuspecting little girls, and then it opens its door and then kind of rolls backwards and scoops them up.
Oh, it's like that. There's a vampire movie where that was the same setup.
Reflecting Skin kind of had a little bit of that.
Hashtag pedicar.
So can we cut in an Amber Alert every time he says pedicar?
That should be the siren.
Yeah, the honk.
Yeah. But basically, you don't know what the deal with the car is. Is it supernatural? Who's behind the wheel? You never find out.
And
what happens?
I love that about
exactly.
Duel,
so what happens is these girls are picked up, and then they're found, like, sexually assaulted.
What?
Yes. They have a town meeting and they're like, yeah, we found little Susie. She was sexually abused, but what? She's doing okay. She's in recovery. And you're like, oh my God.
They're announcing this at a town meeting.
At a town meeting. Really, really lurid stuff. And you're like, oh my God, this got really dark for
a car.
You
said it was a TV movie,
remote.
Right?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And so, sure enough, because Joanna Cassidy has a daughter, this thing starts tracking her daughter and the movie culminates in, I didn't clock this, but I gotta say it was a 25-minute chase scene. It felt like 25 minutes long, where Joanna Cassidy is dropping off a bunch of kids in the school bus and the car starts following the bus. And then she's like, that's the car. And then she starts chasing the car.
Are the kids on the bus?
And the kids are on the bus going, let us off. She's doing all these like hard turns and stuff. It is the most boring car chase sequence in history because the director, Christopher Kane, doesn't know how to shoot. So once she deposits the kids,
he'll never be on the show.
Sorry, Christopher Kane.
Once she gets rid of the kids and it's just her in the souped up bus versus the car, it is a giant chase sequence through town and through all these dusty roads.
Is she still doing the bus route? We're like, hold on, I gotta drop off Timmy.
No, she like literally, she finds a safe zone and she's just like, here you go, kids, call the cops. And then off she goes. And it just ends in a very explosive way that is very satisfying, even if the entire movie is absolutely stupid. There's just like, the car sequence is just like a lot of chase sequences, a lot of slow-mo close-up shots of Joanna Cassidy behind the wheel of this bus with the hair blowing in her wind and the dust kicking up everywhere. And you're like, oh my God. And it all culminates in this like kind of a quarry. And
Did you watch this on VHS?
I did watch this on VHS.
Is that the only way it's available? Wheels of Terror.
Wheels of Terror is the only way it's available on VHS.
I love this tagline. It says, evil waits with the motor running.
Yep. It's a great cover, man.
That's good.
That is why I hand-selected the tape because I saw the cover and I was like, oh, this satisfies my carsploitation Jones.
Wow.
You could do a great all-nighter of just car things.
Oh, yeah.
It'd be so easy. And it'd be fun. They're also different. You know?
Vanishing Point's one of my favorite movies.
No, but I mean like horror ones. Vanishing Point. Yeah.
But I will say Wheels of Terror is, I think you can find it on YouTube. So, you know, if you want to check it out. It's a lot of fun.
Speaking of things that you can do in exploitation films that you cannot do in real life, besides doing a chase scene with kids on a bus in the car, he drives his kids to school on a motorcycle with no helmets.
Yeah, no helmets.
both the girls. What are they from? Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
That's both of them. Yeah.
Driving to school on a motorcycle.
But
the car
Wheels of Terror would make a great double feature, even if one of them is subpar quality.
Wow. next up for me, I checked out Arrow Video just put out Reanimator on a pretty fancy double disc,
very nice set.
Deluxe edition, and the version I want. I mean, I've always been used to, I guess, what would be referred to as the unrated cut of the movie, as far back as I can remember from Anchor Bay's original DVD release and onward. Mm-hmm. And I was never aware that there was a R-rated version that didn't have any of the gore, but had all these extra scenes in it. And so with this Arrow disc, disc two has a version called Reanimator, the integral version, it's a digital restoration that combines the unrated version.
Like the hypnotism stuff?
Yes.
Meg and,
There's all the extra scenes are in. So this is technically, I wouldn't call it a director's cut because I was actually talking about this with Jesse Merlin, who was in the Reanimator musical, and he was saying, he's like, oh, Stewart watched it and thought it was kind of weird because it's not
his version of the movie, but it is a version of Reanimator with everything they shot. Because there was a ton of material in it. But that's the version I chose to watch because I was like, oh, I'm unfamiliar with this and it's got an extra like 20 minutes or whatever. And I thought it was really cool. I thought the two main additions that I thought were really, they're not necessary, but I thought they added a lot to the movie in terms of the plot is that Dr. Hill is like a master hypnotist. So there's scenes that end like when Dan Cain picks up Barbara Crampton for the first time for dinner, like, oh, we're going to go study or whatever. As soon as she leaves, Dr. Hill's staring at the dean who likes Dan, who likes the boy, and is basically hypnotizing him, saying he's dangerous. He lives with that West guy. Mm. You must keep your daughter away. And then he starts repeating it. And so Dr. Hill is a much, much more of a manipulator because he uses hypnosis on all these characters. Hmm. He does it to Barbara Crampton a few times. And it's all scenes I don't remember being in the actual movie.
I remember it was like on the Image Laserdisc special features. But the hypnotism thing builds up to the fact that he can control Dean Halsey when Dean Halsey comes back from the grave.
Exactly,
from the dead.
And the dead in general. He kind of has control over them. So I thought that was super cool, that added element. And the other cool scene that's not in it is that Herbert is addicted to a very small dosage of the reagent.
That's right.
Really? Like
he puts that makes it, a lot of sense.
There's a point where he's putting it in him and Dan, I can't remember the character's name, but Dan Cain's character comes in. He's like, what are you doing? He's like, it's a diluted version. I need it to just keep going, you know? And I was like, oh, that's kind of neat.
That's an interesting plot point that I feel like it could have been better used.
Yeah, no, all that stuff makes sense. It's a lot longer version of the movie. And I think it's not complete though. Somebody told me it was missing a dream sequence, which I don't remember off the top of my head. It's been a while since I've seen the movie. Mm. I think there's one thing missing from it, but otherwise it's the most complete version of Reanimator out there. And it's basically a bonus feature on this new Arrow disc.
That's cool. I'll have to check that
out. Yeah, and I mean, it's worth watching if you love the movie. Being the most complete version doesn't mean it's the definitive version. I said, Stewart prefers, I think, the unrated cut. That's technically his director's cut.
Right.
But I mean, I love that, you know, people like Arrow and Scream Factory are restoring these alternate cuts of movies for us to enjoy. Because it's a perfectly restored version of it. Okay. So super cool. Yeah. No, I mean, all the features are fantastic. So
nice.
Yeah. And it's sold out now?
I don't know. I know
it's getting dangerously close. People, Diabolik posted saying like, once these are gone, that's it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because they don't sell. I mean, basically the deluxe version is what they're talking about. Okay. Like there will always be a version in print. Like you can still get Creepshow 2, for example, but the first pressing of it came with a slightly fancier box and like a comic book.
Okay.
So this deluxe version of Reanimator has the Dark Horse comic book completely reprinted.
Right, yeah.
Which is kind of neat, you know? So I think it'll be available, but just not with the comic book.
Okay.
I just saw Reanimator recently, which is why I haven't like dug into the box set, but knowing that it's got this alternate cut, I'll watch it with fresh eyes.
Super cool, yeah.
I have been nerding out on TV, so I don't have any of my other movies, which is rare. I'm like halfway or over halfway through Ozark,
which terrific.
I'm really liking. Yeah. Where it's different from Breaking Bad is Breaking Bad has this nice progression of a normal guy who goes there. This Ozark,
is all right
episode
from the
one, it's like now you're two seasons into Breaking Bad and you're like, whoa, how fast is this thing moving? But I'm enjoying it so far. Super dark. I mean, it's pretty, each episode you're like, oh God, like who are these people?
But you know what, Jason Bateman's great in it.
He's really good.
Wow. It's funny, for people that don't like him, I'm like, well, I think The Gift and Ozark are like the reasons he was you've been waiting for these characters.
The Gift made me reappraise him because I thought he was so good in it.
Yeah.
And then this is just a very different kind of role.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I don't have as much films this week.
Well, I have a couple of others. So I have been taking the subway. I'm teaching a couple classes at USC in the cinema department this semester. And so I've been taking the subway there. So I have like a 45-minute ride there and a 45-minute ride back. And so I've been reading a ton. I reread a ton of graphic novels. But I also just this week worked my way through 3 Lois Duncan novels. Because I know I'd been talking a couple of shows ago. I mentioned about how much I used to love Stranger with My Face. And so I went back and read Stranger with My Face. I read The Gallows or Gallows Hill, which is her witch one. Oh. And then I also read Down a Dark Hall, which after I read it, I was like, this one's really good. This one would make a great movie. It's a movie coming out in 2017 starring Uma Thurman and Isabel Furman, directed by someone named Rodrigo Cortez. But oh. Down a...
Yeah, Rodrigo. Yeah.
You familiar?
Did, Buried.
Yes. And so I'm kind of psyched. At first I was like, this would be amazing as a film. And then I was like, oh, okay. Well, somebody else thought that too. But I'm excited to see what they do with Down a Dark Hallway. But yeah, the other thing that I watched this week was, I think I talked about this a few years back on Killer POV, is Animorph. I revisited. And this is not the cartoon, which everyone confuses it with.
I was about to say.
No. And this was part of the problem when it came out. So Animorph came out in 2006. And I loved it when it came out, and I watched it, and I remember speaking about it on Killer POV. And then last week, I saw somebody online completely dogging it about how it was horrible, and I was like, I really liked it. I need to rewatch it and see if, you know, I was just in like the heat of the moment, if it still, if it suddenly sucks. And no, I still really liked it. This is 2007, directed by a person named Henry Miller. Stars Willem Dafoe and Clea Duvall.
Willem Dafoe, I remember this now.
And this was, it's a serial killer movie. It's like a moody little serial killer movie, and it was definitely kind of right after Seven. It feels like it was kind of, you know, riding on the wave of Seven, and it does feel a little bit like Seven. And it's a serial killer who is obsessed with art and kind of turns his victims into art, but leaves clues inside the artwork. So you have to know a lot about like different art styles and how you look at them from various perspectives to kind of figure out what the clue is. And I always really liked this one. Everybody that I saw, I was reading critical responses at that point, and it was really mixed. Like, some people were like, this is really clever. It's really gory, too, really gory. And some people were like, you know, the gore outweighs any of the actual plot. But I still found it really intriguing, some really good twists in it. And I'm always down for a good murder mystery, and this one still, I loved it.
That's like one of those movies time forgot.
It is.
I remember the cover distinctly.
Yeah. And the cover sucks. It's like literally Willem Dafoe's face, Clea Duvall, and a skull. Yeah. And it says nothing about the movie.
Sold.
But yeah, like I've just always found it to be kind of clever. So I'm anxious to see what some of our listeners say about it. If you've seen it and liked it, and if I'm like the only person in the world who's like, yeah, it's a good movie. What's up with all the hate?
I like that Willem Dafoe. He's all right.
Yeah, he's good. Movie also has Debbie Harry in it for like a minute. And Mick Foley plays an antiques dealer.
Oh, God.
Nice.
Yeah.
Mick Foley, the wrestler?
Yes.
Oh, God.
Is in it. And it doesn't even, like, if you don't know exactly who Mick Foley is, you wouldn't even realize it's him, because he's very, like, you know, in it for just a second, and he literally plays an antique dealer who sells Willem Dafoe a chair, I think. Wow. And he's in it for like a hot
minute.
He
sells him a chair?
A chair.
How apropos, since wrestlers throw chairs.
So.
Did Willem Dafoe throw it?
Totally intentional.
Did break it over Mick Foley's head?
The chair does become a thing. So it may have gotten, I don't think it got thrown actually.
Do we have any other?
Animorph.
How many Debbie Harry horrors can we think of? Videodrome, what's the?
Tales from the Dark Side, the movie.
Any others, you think?
There's got to be more.
Hopefully one of you is going to tweet at us right in this silence.
Well, and while we're discussing Debbie Harry Harrys, Debbie Harry Harrys. I did happen to look up some Sandra Bullock horror movies.
Oh, shit.
Oh, wow. So she was in The Vanishing. Do we consider that a horror film?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
The remake of that.
Yeah, the remake.
The
Net. No.
Murder
Cyber
by Numbers.
Thriller.
Murder by Numbers. That's mom horror.
Then it gets into the rest are mom horror. Lake House, which was the one I was remembering.
Lake House is a romance with Keanu. Yeah, I liked it. It touched me.
Isn't she getting like letters from somebody?
Somebody might be deceased. Yeah, but that's not horror. It's not horror.
But it's a dead dude.
Sweet.
Okay, fine. And then Premonition, which was just kind of a
not horror. That was the very first film I covered for Fangoria when I first started at Fango.
So it's horror.
No, I said. To Tony, I was like, Tony, what do you want me to do with this?
It's pretty much like if Lifetime wanted to make kind of an edgy thriller, then you get Premonition. And even that, I mean, like, it's not so good.
This is the most love that Sandra Bullock has ever gotten on any horror podcast ever.
You know what? It's goddamn time, because I was obsessed with Sandy B in college.
Yeah. She did do Demolition Man, so let's all pour out a cold one for
Sandra. The scariest thing she did is that sequence in Gravity. There's sequences of Gravity that were really just scary. Mm-hmm. Edge of your seat entertainment.
We're still talking about Sandra Bullock.
But Deborah Harry was also in Body Bags.
The one with the hair extensions?
Yeah, that's right, she's his partner.
It's really funny though.
Okay, so
look at all the answers we gave people today.
Animorph. So a little film called Don't Panic came my way.
Oh my gosh, this is the Mexican film that came up last week to Freddy.
Yes, it did. The 88 Mexican film. We were going to show it at CineFamily, or at least Blumhouse was going to be part of that, but probably not.
Why would they want to pull their brand from that?
But this is the 1988 Mexican horror film that was released here in the States on a now out-of-print DVD. I watched it late one night and had my mind blown because it is the most bonkers batshit thing I've seen this year.
I want to see it now.
And the best synopsis I can give about the film is it's a dude celebrating his 17th birthday. He actually looks like he's 24. Him and his friends are playing with a Ouija board, and they unleash a vengeful spirit. And then our hero runs around inexplicably in his dinosaur jammies.
Oh, he's that one.
That's the one
I mentioned last week. Yeah.
Trying not to be implicated in the rash of murders that have broken out all around.
Wait, so you seeing this had nothing to do with our last episode?
No.
Oh, wow.
I saw it 2 weeks before the episode.
Still Panic's making a crazy comeback.
Yeah, I know. I love it. Nowhere.
And then in the experience of playing with the Ouija board, he has like this somewhat like power where his eyes get red and he could see the murders taking place. But again, he's running around in his jammies. But the good thing is that he manages to fall in love with a girl over the course of 24 hours. He manages to sleep with her, and then he manages to ditch her because of the shit that's going down. And then it just kind of gets into other crazy slasher Freddy Krueger ripoff territory. But it's like, God, it is basically a reflection of what the U.S. was putting out at the time. And it was doing so in a very kind of funhouse mirror sort of way. Yeah. It wasn't exactly scary, but it's just full of like abstract ideas and thoughts. And the and it's just insane. It's weird. It's a very weird, dreamy movie. That doesn't have much logic. And
now, this one has been released to DVD, right?
It was released to DVD at one time on like some sort of Mexican horror collection on a very racist cover, which had like a skeleton popping out of the grave with a sombrero.
Oh,
and
my.
I was just like, oh, God. And that DVD is now out of print.
a collector's item.
Yeah. But if you're able to find Don't Panic, if you're not living in Los Angeles, I'm sure you might be able to find it somewhere. But if you're able to find Don't Panic on eBay or something, do yourself a favor and just get schooled.
Wait, so you check it out. You had found a print of this?
I found a copy. And CineFamily, yeah, there was
they were going to do a print.
There is a 35. Here's the deal. There's a 35 millimeter print that exists.
Okay.
Friday Night Frights and us, we were going to do a collab screening at the end of September. But in recent events, I don't feel like we should be screening.
Yeah, so maybe that could happen down the road somewhere else. Or
it might still very well happen. It just won't happen without us.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So they might still show. Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
TBD.
TBD.
Yeah, we should do an all night Freddy ripoff marathon. Turkish movie.
That should just be an episode.
Yeah, there
Freddy
we go.
Ripoffs.
Bad Dreams is great.
We talked about doing a ripoff episode before because we wanted to talk about the Turkish Exorcist.
We'll never get away. We'll never do better than the Pure Cinema with Steve Scarlatta.
That was
you
pretty
did. Because those ripoff titles were out of control.
He had ones that never
But we're going to touch on them.
I'm going to do like a nightmare, all nightmare stuff. That's fun.
That would be fun.
Nightmare would be fun.
I'm going to wrap up with it's three quickie titles, and they all are related in the sense that they're all knockoff movies, and it'll also help guide us into our topic of we're going to break down specific exploitation stuff that kind of caters to us. Becca's going to get to go nuts on nunsploitation if she wants. This is the time. So, but for me, I saw three movies. One was Beyond the Darkness from 1979, aka Buo Omega.
Is that how you pronounce it? Buo?
I guess. I'm taking a guess. But Bayua? I'm going to call it Beyond the
Darkness. I think it's called A Bleak Look Into Your Soul.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
And this was put out by Severn Films because, of course, who else would put out something like this?
Oh, man.
Bless those guys for that. And it is a weird, crazy movie. To me, and maybe it's because I just watched Reanimator, it felt a little like a Reanimator ripoff because, but he doesn't bring the girl back. His girlfriend dies in the beginning, but he just keeps your corpse
around.
It's
more necrophilia.
This whole necrophilic thing, and he's got this weird relationship with, I thought it was a member of his family, but I guess it's not.
Oh, really? Yeah, my memory was as a mom or something. But
he's like a momish character, and he's kind of got a very incestuous thing going on with her. But it's bonkers, and it kind of makes no sense. It looks amazing because Severin always restores these movies to all their glory, for better or worse. It's one of the grossest movies I've ever seen. Like, there's actually a moment where that older mom, whatever she is like eating like meat or something, and it's like close-ups of her mouth to the point where the lead character goes and vomits in the corner. Like, it is actually that gross. We're like, oh God, I think I want to vomit now too.
I mean, it was a very controversial movie. It's just one of those kind of nasties that everyone was always...
It's very bizarre. I mean, there was one scene where, because the main character is kind of like this good-looking dude, so there's one point where he's out, like, I guess for a jog, and a female jogger, a very attractive female jogger, bends her ankle or something, and he's like, oh, let me tie that up for you. And he brings her to the house, and somehow within seconds they're already getting it on and getting ready to sleep with each other.
Oh, wow.
So they go into the room, which has got like double beds, and they're making out, and he like pulls the sheet on the next bed to reveal the body of his dead girlfriend. He's like, I'm gonna make out with her with this dead corpse next to me. And then finally, of course, she turns and sees it. And then when he does, he just takes a bite out of her, like,
that's
randomly.
That's right, yeah.
And you're like, what am I watching?
I have this on Blue. And
you do?
I've been trying to work up to watching it. Trying to work up to it.
Save that one with the kid.
I was going to say,
No, definitely not for the kid.
Wait for the girlfriend to go to sleep and just move on.
Great Goblin score, though. I'll give you that.
I do have, well, it came with the CD. The Blu-ray comes with the CD,
The score is great. That's the
best. I didn't even remember that about it.
Yeah. So I saw Beyond the Darkness, and in keeping with the Beyond theme, I also got Beyond the Door from 1974 from Code Red.
Yeah, it's a funny movie.
That one is another one that just makes zero sense to me. An Exorcist ripoff. Not necessarily a good one, but bonkers. Like the editing choices where the lead guy is kind of like a music producer in the beginning while the girl is dropping off with the kids. The kids are all dubbed in the movie, right?
I think there are a couple versions, but this is the same director as The Visitor. And the one we were just talking about, Madhouse.
Madhouse.
So we're talking other bonkers.
That makes a lot more sense now.
And this movie with a crowd is really fun.
Like, I'm sure.
It's a laugh fest, but it is such a bizarre ripoff. I mean,
yeah, it is an Exorcist ripoff with weird editing choices. There's one part where she's like freaking out saying she's going to kill you, but it keeps like freeze framing on her as she keeps like flipping.
And it's
set
in San Francisco, I think.
Yeah.
Or somewhere. Somewhere
it's one of those movies, much like we were discussing last week, where there's no way human beings made it. Like, it's like aliens saw The Exorcist and like, we could do that.
Wait, so
and
that's very revealing when the same guy has made multiple films that no human could have made. Maybe there's something
there,
guys.
He's
The Visitor.
And then to wrap it up, the last ripoff I saw, Kino Lorber had a big sale a couple of weeks ago, and I picked up Jennifer from 1978, which is actually like a Carrie ripoff, except she summons snakes out of nowhere. Yeah, that's not good.
What do the snakes do?
Nothing. They just kind of show up and they like hiss and like attack
strike
people.
You.
Yeah, but it's very much, you know, it's the same deal as Carrie, where they pick on her because she's different, and they're all bragging about sleeping with celebrities. That's a pretty funny scene. We're like, oh, how good was Warren Beatty or whatever it was. Like actually like naming them and stuff. Like that's what the cool girls did, is they sleep with celebrities and stuff. Then of course they play a prank on her and she loses it and brings snakes out. It's pretty wild, not good though, but if you want to keep it the ripoff theme, I would suggest that.
Nice.
Jennifer.
Well, let me keep on going with the not good theme. So there was a weird experiment that I was going to play recently, which was I was just going to select a year and then watch a lot of films that came out within that year. Like everything that I chose, next movie to watch would be within that year. So Ciara and I sat down. We were like, let's do 1994.
Ooh.
And so we were like, okay, let's like go through the films in 1994. And I go, you know what I haven't seen in forever? Robert Heinlein's The Puppet Masters.
Oh.
So this is the movie with Donald Sutherland.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in 94, I was in film school, and I saw it opening night, and I remember going, wow, this has got a little bit of charm to it. It's kind of exciting and fun and sci-fi and horror. No, the movie's bad. It doesn't hold up at all.
I don't remember thinking it was good.
I thought it was cool, man. I thought it was like one of those little gems. I was like, oh, everybody needs to see The Puppet Masters.
How about a new show called Podcast to a Young Ryan? Yeah. And it's just you talking to your younger self, giving advice on his day.
I'd just be like, fuck you, older Turek. But this movie, if you guys didn't know, it's about an alien takeover of a small town and the government officials that try to stop it. It came out during, like, you know, when X-Files was popular and on the rise.
And it had a body snatcher
vibe. Well, it's a body snatcher.
It almost felt like In the World because of Sutherland being.
Don't quote me on this, but I think the Heinlein story came out before Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Basically, they're not like so much they basically duplicate your body. They are these kind of like space stingrays that have long tentacles and they attach themselves to your back and then they stick a little thing into your brain. And
I remember that.
Yeah. Sutherland is in it. Sutherland obviously being an invasion of the body snatchers. You know, it's really weird. The logic of the aliens is a little wonky because, you know, you've got these pod people kind of walking around with like the giant stingrays attached to their back. I can't imagine that feels good with clothing on.
Yeah.
It was just, it's a very weird movie. And you can see all the studio notes that they were shoving down the director's throat. Eric Thal and Julie Warner star. And they're just like, the chemistry is so weird. Yeah. There's a moment where she finds him after having been attacked, like been taken over by an alien, and they removed it from him. And she walks into a shower, and there he is, like sobbing on the shower floor, and he's crying. And then he's like kind of crawling along the tile. Oh no, I miss it. I miss it so much. And she comes running in with her clothes on, gets under the shower, and she picks him up like a baby. And then he's like, oh, I can still feel it inside me. And she's like, come to me. And then they start making out. And then she's like, no, this is a bad idea. And then she gives him a little baby hug. Very weird fucking movie.
That was anticlimactic. I was hoping for more there.
No, I know. But it starts strong. I mean, like, in the first 5 minutes, this town gets taken over and government officials are on the scene and they're already fighting aliens in a crazy chase sequence. And then it just kind of flatlines.
Yeah.
Reminds me of Phantoms from that sort of...
It's that era, you know? It's definitely that era where it's like studio just throwing a ton of money at what they think is going to work with this X-File thing. Tommyknockers. That was that. And then I want to also just kind of throw a little nod to Night Trap, which just hit the PlayStation, which just hit the video game scene again. This was a video game that came out in
The Dana Plato one?
Holy
shit.
It came out in 1992, and it was basically like a movie. It's a movie. Mm-hmm. It's cinema. It's all live action. But you in the game play basically someone who is in this control center monitoring all these like kind of security monitors. And you're in communication with Dana Plato, who is a secret agent that has infiltrated a slumber party of teenage girls. And there are all these home invaders called, I think they're called augers. And they're just dudes dressed in black with hooks and claws and stuff like that. And basically, you just need to like watch security monitor to security monitor. And in each one, there's some vignette happening. There's dialogue occurring. There's characters interacting. There's like the beginning, you have the mom and dad who come in with Andres Jones from Nightmare 4.
Yeah.
And they're like, hey, so when you guys have a party tonight, play it safe, da 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 da. We'll be at the neighbor's house. And then you can click over to monitor 3. The girls are already arriving and you're getting to meet all the characters. Or you could click back to monitor 2 and you can see the parents leaving the house. And what you're supposed to do is go from monitor to monitor, watch the home invaders and try to trap these guys. And it's just like through a series of quick button mashing and then you trap them. But halfway through the game, you need to listen to the dialogue to change the code to trap these guys. So a character will go, Becca, let's change the security code to blue. And you're like, fuck, how do I change the security code to blue so I can trap these guys? And if you miss it, then you fuck up and you die. Mm-hmm. I lost Elric, but it's a really, really fascinating game.
The whole
game.
Time you're talking, though, like Rob had it up on IMDb, like, is this a movie? Is this a game?
No, it's both a
movie and a game.
It was really fascinating, actually. I remember it when it came out being like really into it. And actually, you can listen to an episode of my other podcast, Our Strange World. We do an entire episode on horror video games, but a large chunk of it is on 90s horror video games. So we talk like Gabriel Knight, Seventh Guest, Phantasmagoria was one of them. Mm. But yeah, so that one, I remember
It came under fire from a lot of parent groups.
Yeah, I found an article that says Sega's most shameful, sick, and disgusting video game.
It's so tame. It's so tame.
Yeah, like really nothing happens. It is.
They really do.
He's correct.
The images look
there are no rapes in it.
Oh, really?
I will confirm.
Yeah. She's like wearing lingerie and she's surrounded by men in black hoods all like poking at
it. It is weird. It's
they definitely kind of gave it a sexy sheen, I will say, but there's nothing rapey in it. I just recall it as like a basic slasher, but it does play as a movie. And this was definitely at the start of the video games where you do get like a lot of video action where it's like, you know, you get a couple of seconds of button mashing and then a 10-minute video goes along with it. And so this was a lot of that.
Yeah.
All right.
Good stuff. But what was fascinating about the re-release of Night Trap is that they remastered it. They added some new stuff. But they only put 5,000 copies of, like, you know, one platform out into the world. So I woke up at 7:30 in the morning going, I'm going to get my physical Night Trap for PlayStation 4. And I sat down and 7:30 rolls around. I hit click in my cart. I'm like, oh, what else do they have? Oh, they got t-shirts. Let me see this. Uh-oh. And I go over to the t-shirt. I click on the t-shirt. Oh, nope. It's no longer in my cart because it fucking sold out in 3 minutes tops. So I had to wait for $15 downloaded version. I think I won. So anyways, that is crazy. Night Trap. Wow.
Yeah. Well, while I'm watching on screen, I'm going to stay with Rapey. Because it
looks so crazy. Something called Infamous Bathroom Death. And it's going over pretty as you'd expect. But anyway.
All right, well, let's take a break for a second and then we'll come back with exploitation.
Yes.
Just a reminder, this episode is brought to you by Fright Rags. Right now, we're offering a discount code of Shockwaves0817, Shockwaves0817, which is good through midnight Eastern time.
End of September.
End of September.
September 30th.
Yeah.
And you can use that code and you can get a discount on some incredible horror merch. They have pants. They have shirts. They have amazing cereal socks if you need
amazing cereal socks.
Frankenberry socks. They have like
if you're
mad
a cereal
ball socks.
Killer. Where the cereal socks.
No, they have all types of crazy stuff. Amazing enamel pins. And just this week, they are releasing the Evil Dead 2 stuff.
To get some Elvira shirts. I saw they made so many Elvira shirts. I didn't know which one to choose, so I might just get them all.
Yeah.
And if you have been listening to this episode, they have a sweet-ass hatchet shirt.
Hey!
For those who are paying attention.
Wow. Yes.
Multiple versions. So stay in the groove.
That's right.
That's all you got. That's their new motto via Elric.
Hatchet.
Stay in the groove.
All right. So we're talking about
Fright Dash Rags. Fright Dash Rags.com.
All right, this month has been exploitation month here at Shockwaves. We kicked it off with some shark exploitation.
Yeah.
And it carried through to the Day of the Woman episode.
And
which
today
is
all ploitation.
All ploitation.
All cards
are on
the table.
The homework was to select 5 subgenres of exploitation, choose one title that we like from that category. And just kind of riff on it.
Yeah.
And
probably no one followed the rules, but you know.
No, we didn't.
No, I totally followed the rules.
So
I got 4.
So I have a list of Sandra Bullock films.
All right. Well,
why don't we start with asking everyone, like, just more generally, do you have a favorite, like, actual go-to category when it comes to exploitation films that you almost will always watch that kind? Like, we all talk about you liking non-exploitation, whether it's true or not. It's become a thing.
It has become a thing, but what's I'm interested, I have to, like, qualify the terms will always go to because I love studying nunsploitation films and the patterns and how they break the formula or do different things depending on where the film is originating from. Mm-hmm. But that said, it's never like it's a Saturday night at 8 p.m. I think I'll watch Flavia the Heretic. Like those never dawn on me.
Funny
it's
because
like,
I thought that's exactly how I went.
I'm pretty sure every listener thinks that's exactly what Becca
that's
would
when
be
I watch like Escape from. I mean, I'm still watching exploitation films during those time. It's just nunsploitation films tend to be really heavy. They tend to be really torture heavy. They tend to have a lot of kind of more of even I'll say rapey overtones to them. Some of them. Do.
Using that word.
So it's, you know, those aren't exactly ones that they fascinate me as films and they're ones that I'm really fascinated in studying and learning from, but I would never just be like, I'm bored. Let's throw on. Yeah. But I did include one on my list today. So that I probably would throw
well,
on.
Well, let's start with you. What was your first subgenre of exploitation? What's the title that you think best fits your taste?
I went with sexploitation.
Okay.
Which is a very broad. I mean, like we still. Coming in hot here.
Yeah.
And I debated because I wanted to include some that, you know, I think are kind of quintessential titles. So even though that they're not necessarily horror, I thought about doing Felicity, which is an Ozploitation. I thought about including Bad Girls Go to Hell or some of the Doris Wishman stuff, which if you haven't seen, you need to check out Doris Wishman. She one of the few female filmmakers who actually like survived in exploitation for such a long time, like literally decades. But I ended up going back to the origins, some of the earliest exploitation. Dwayne Esper's Sex Madness, aka Human Wreckage, aka The Story That Must Be Told from 1938.
Wow.
Just because these films, these are what they called hygiene films, somewhat. The hygiene films, he has some other ones like How to Take a Bath that get a little bit more into kind of the hygiene films, like Mom and Dad, where they were supposed to be educational. So this one gets into kind of these alarmist films. Like he also made Reefer Madness and Marijuana with an H, which were these films that were supposed to be educating you on the dangers of using it. And just like Reefer Madness, this one is considerably over the top. In Reefer Madness, he takes like one puff and goes like completely psychotic. In Sex Madness, it's about this girl who wins a beauty pageant in her small town. She moves to New York City and decides to become a showgirl. Ends up on the casting couch, has sex with a foreigner, gets syphilis.
Rick, what are you doing with that bottle?
Nothing. She's put the bottle back.
she has sex, gets syphilis, then is forced to undergo what they call a long, painstaking process to get rid of the syphilis. And then, oh no, now she can't marry her sweetheart, Wendell, because she has syphilis. So,
damn right she can. Wendell's so, smart than that.
Wendell knows the drill.
So much syphilis.
Yeah, I know, so much syphilis.
It's a syphilis tsunami, as they would say actually, West Hollywood billboards.
There's actually a scene where, and I don't include this film seriously. I include it as like, if you're having a party with people or if you find these films hilarious, like I do, you cannot miss Sex Madness. There's actually a scene where she's talking with some of the other burlesque dancers, many of whom are lesbians because they portray that as being like this wild and loose lifestyle. And then some of them are like, oh, well, I got syph. You got syph. We all got syph here. Welcome to New York City. Everybody got syph. And then she gets it from sleeping with this guy on a casting couch.
Wow.
And oh, the lessons learned. So yeah, this is kind of your early, early days of exploitation when there were all of these different censorship codes in place, but the quickest way to get around them and actually show like some weird stuff, like Mom and Dad has nudity in it and things like that, was to say it's educational and it's educating the public. So yeah, early days of exploitation.
And it was in its way, I'm sure.
Yes.
There's one I was excited about at one point called Cinderella 2000. It's directed by Al Adamson, big hard, you know, kind of the tier that lives somewhere below Herschel Gordon Lewis, if that's a place you're comfortable watching. It is not a good movie. I spent years trying to track it down, and I finally saw it. I was like, oh, it's so clunky. But it's kind of cool, sci-fi porn, like Emmanuel in Space kind of thing. You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's better. At least it has that going for it. But there's some weird ones that where that crosses over exploitation. It goes between sexploitation, but then it's also the borders on the rape revenge. Like they call her One Eye.
Yeah,
and Thriller would cut to sequences of really just porn in, you know, spliced in amongst an actual drama.
But
which was a little unusual.
In the 60s, that was a whole subgenre of the exploitation world where they started out calling roughies. And then I'd also heard them punch me, fuck me, kill me films, which is far more.
I thought that was a recent game. Like,
yeah. No. and that may have been a contemporary title that was applied to these films. Mostly, I heard them called roughies.
Yeah, roughies was definitely.
Yeah, that's definitely like the go-to title form. But yeah, it is very much like films where they still work as sexploitation films, but instead of the actual sex, somebody always ends up punching somebody else. So you'll have like weird foreplay and then it'll get violent.
Let's just say a really good entry point for all this topic, especially for today, is called American Grindhouse by our friend Elijah
Such
Drenner.
Such a good book. Because, sorry, that's a movie.
Well, it's I don't think if you've seen a lot of stuff, I don't think it's quite as good. I think it's such a great primer for like a door foothold into that world. And he's got interviews with people who aren't here anymore, like Ray Dennis Stickler and stuff, who are just, it's phenomenal on that level. And it will give you clips of, because he has a section on the roughies.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that when you said that word, it's like, oh, I remember that in that documentary. So, you know, if you're looking for a good kind of thing to watch with this episode.
Sure. And I don't
if you can multitask.
I mean, I'd also recommend Not Quite Hollywood, although that's specifically considered exploitation, but they really do run the gamut of every type of exploitation was made in Australia. So that's kind of
And it's funny how these things are called like exploitation when really it's mostly Americans going to Australia to exploit Australia.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't even know some of them are Australian movies. Sometimes it's just passing it off as an American or a British film. You know, it's interesting.
And there's a whole bunch of books I would recommend as well, like Sleazewood Express, The Sleaze Merchants is really good. There's one called Grindhouse for Adults Only that's really good. So yeah, there's a bunch of them. So yeah, that is my, anybody else have a sexploitation inclusion?
I do not have one, but I do have an, do you, Rob?
That's kind of, yeah, it's kind of my main thing.
Sexploitation?
Oh, kind of,
kind of. Oh, shit.
That's your jam? I never knew that.
No, well, this is weird and it requires.
Well, how come together when
you're into sex,
when it's
Rob?
Just me and you? You've never talked about this. I'm on your couch.
I'm not watching those movies with you, Elric. What, damn. Are you kidding? No. Italian ripoffs,
please.
Maybe. But
everybody, everybody, wear protection. Rob is about to hit us with some sexploitation.
All right,
holy
let's hit
shit.
It.
No,
get your syphilis on.
This requires, no, I feel unfortunately, this requires, for some reason, Becca could talk about it with no problem.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like it requires some explanation on my
Becca
point before.
Rebecca could drop vocab like roughies and Japanese pinky porn.
I have some Japanese pinky porn. I'm going to talk about it in about 5 minutes.
Which is good because I'm going into pink cinema, which you can lead into.
I will get there in a second.
And basically, I mean, the only way I want to preface this, because there's no way I cannot come off sounding kind of weird talking about this stuff, is when I worked at Amoeba for a couple of years, and I was in charge of both the horror, but primarily the cult section. And what I loved about the cult section at Amoeba in particular was it was very specified. It wasn't like we were just putting weird movies together and alphabetizing them, but we had basic cult stuff. We had directors, so things like David Lynch movies or Herschel Gordon Lewis or Jim Jarmusch, those all fell into the cult section.
Yeah.
And then it really got broken down. So obviously Giallo, which is the Italian horror stuff, and then Poliziotteche, which I could talk about later. That's kind of the Italian action knockoffs, right, in the same way that the giallos are the Italian horror murder mysteries. You know, then there's like the trailer ones, which are just trailer reels. Those are kind of fun. But then, you know, the further you go into the cult section, the more it becomes smut, if you will. And most people like kind of, you know, smirk and laugh at the
smut.
The
more you go
stuff.
To the right.
The more you go to the right.
I've done it recently.
The dirtier it's going to get. Yeah, yeah. But no, I'm fascinated by a lot of those movies. And I think one of the entry points into it was the Emmanuel series, but I didn't start with the French ones. I started with Black Emmanuel, which is
that's a good one.
What's your name? Laura Gemser, who's very beautiful, and she played this version of Emmanuel through several films. I have a couple of box sets that have those movies, and I can't explain what it is that's appealing about them. The first one was one that I think Bill Lustig put out through Blue Underground, or maybe it was through Anchor Bay when he was still at Anchor Bay, called Emmanuel in America.
Oh yeah.
And it starred her, but I think this nails the head on what makes exploitation stand out. Is it's a pretty traditional story where Laura Gemser is like a photographer that goes to some remote island or whatever, and at the island they randomly insert like actual, you know, porn scenes. Mm. And it just kind of takes you off guard because it's not the sort of thing that you see in a regular movie, and it's kind of not acceptable in a regular movie. And yet you're watching a regular movie. It was shot on film. It's got score. It's a regular movie. So I remember that just being a little blown away by that. I was like, ooh, I'm seeing something I'm not supposed to. And I kind of think that's the point of exploitation, is not only is it exploiting a certain topic, but they're going to slip in something you've never seen before or that you probably shouldn't see.
Because they don't have to play by the rules.
Exactly.
Of Hollywood.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I always thought that was interesting. So at least my entry point was those movies, the Emmanuel stuff. And then in recent years, I've just become really fascinated by pink cinema. It's Pink Film or Pink Yega or Synapse Films puts out all these under the Nikatsu collection label. And they're, you know, they're bordering on – the thing I like about them is they're just –
What are they bordering on? Your sentence.
They're bordering on adult material, Ryan.
Yes. Okay.
But it's – I'm just fascinated because it's like – it's the Japanese that have perfected – they got this formula. It's all shot in 35 millimeter. They do not exceed 60 to 70 minutes. Mm-hmm. Like they stay really short, and they have – sex scenes either simulated or maybe they're real. You can't tell because they're usually blurred anyway.
Yeah.
They're like three or four per the hour. So like every 15 minutes they will slip one in. But the stories, literally.
Hashtag for the episode. Shockwave, slip one in.
Episode 62, slipping one in.
But But the stories they come up with to make these scenes work are so fucking outrageous. And that's what appeals to me, is because if they didn't have the sex, it'd be bordering on like Tarantino level insanity.
Well, actually, a lot of these went on to influence Tarantino. Like, this is truly where a lot of his stuff comes from. Like the Sex and the Fury series, which I'll be talking about.
I've seen Sex
A lot of influence with him. But there were these long running series within them, like Lynch Law Classroom, and it was Red Porno, I think, was another, or Angel Guts was another one of the series.
Where's the pinky term come from? Is it the pornographic meaning, or is it something else?
Pinky hand.
I don't know. I always assumed that it was like the skin angle. Oh, okay. Yeah. That's why it was pink, but I don't know.
That's what I assume too.
Yeah. So, but I also included.
Tweeted us what you think it is. Can of worms opened.
Don't do that. So I've always liked the Sex and the Fury films. And I also have to throw out another one, Girl Boss Gorilla, which is a female biker gang pink film that I've really enjoyed. And these films in general, Rob talked about the formula. They do something weird where they mix sex, which is sometimes really brutal. Like sometimes it's not, sometimes it's more like, you know, like a porn where it's like casual sex happens. Like, oh, you're here to deliver the pizza. Let's do it. Sometimes it happens casually. And then sometimes it's far more kind of violent and brutal.
Yeah.
But they also somehow always have some element of humor in them. A large portion of them do. Girl Boss Gorilla is kind of a weird one in that regard, where it's almost a comedy, but it's a girl gang. So it's kind of an exploitation biker thing, but then it's got some sex scenes in it. It's the whole thing's kind of bizarre, but it's a wonderful hot mess. I just love that
movie.
It's
the epitome
so
of you never know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Some of them are a little on the rapey side which is the kind of stuff where you're like, ugh, I shouldn't be watching this one. Like, again, I think Synapse's Nakatsu collection is kind of what, if you wanted to delve into this stuff, the closest, I don't really like this one because it is a little too violent, but they did one called Zoom In Sex Apartments, which is totally a giallo, which is basically like this serial rapist that wears black gloves. But then he also sets like their vaginas on fire after.
It's what?
Like, that's what I'm saying. If you eliminate like just the sex parts of these, you're like, that is the craziest fucking giallo idea.
Wait, he sets them on fire in a bad way?
Yeah, no,
oh
like
my
with,
God.
Yes,
with or he's just with that hot. He's like
scorching herpes and a lighter.
He's
and
that
a
lot good. Of
well, I've heard that a few times.
The one that I included is not quite that intense, but it is. I wanted to put in something that's nunsploitation, just because that's what I've become known for. And this is one of my favorite nunsploitations because it is a Japanese pink film. The majority of the nunsploitation films come out of countries where they have predominantly Catholic populations. So you see a lot of Spain. You see a lot out of Italy, and you see a lot out of Mexico. To get a nunsploitation film out of Japan is like crazy. So School of the Holy Beast from 1974.
That's a good movie, though. That's
it
actually
is.
A really good movie.
So that's what I'm getting to. So this, it was
notice
made
I
by...
Notice I preface by saying, though.
Yes. No, this is from Toei Films.
Guys, I don't even need to talk about my picks. I'm just going to roll it back up. Yeah. Let's just keep going, Becca.
I've gone down the rabbit hole of...
So School of the Holy Beast from 1974. This is from Toei, who is like a legit film company. And they did a lot of the pink films, admittedly. So this follows the same plot, the same style, and the same formula of the majority of, and note the paper I printed this on, right? It's taking a picture
I'm
right
taking
now.
A picture of Rebecca's paper because it's literally child paper. It's got the alphabet around as a border of the paper.
I printed out my
middle,
daughter's coloring pages
in the middle
on
of
it.
This children's alphabet with cats and elephants and alligators. It says, School of the Holy Beast.
I love it. All right, call the pedo car. Where's the pedo car?
Pedo car.
Okay, so School of the Holy Beast. So this was made by Toei. Follows the same plot and formula of the majority of the nunsploitation films, where a woman becomes a nun, then discovers that the convent's completely corrupt. There's torture. There's lesbianism, which at the time was perceived as, you know, total corruption for nun. That was always like the climax of these films was like, or maybe they'd kill somebody, but majority it was like, oh, well, I've tried a man, but I'm still hungry. And then it escalates. So it was the formula. You always had to have a lesbian scene in these films. And so it still has all of those things, but it's in a Japanese setting, which definitely adds something different that I'd never seen before. But it's absolutely fucking gorgeous. That's the weirdest thing. This is the most beautifully shot exploitation film. Like, you're watching it and you're like, yeah, yeah, they're like beating her with whips. This is so beautiful. It's just, I don't even know what they were thinking. It's incredibly stylish. It's incredibly artistic. And when you start looking at reviews online, everyone else will say the same thing. They're, yeah, heinous stuff, total sleaze, trash. Oh my God, this is beautiful. So yeah. That's
School for the Holy Beast.
School for the Holy Beast.
I was trying to say, do you remember that movie Horrors of Malformed Man?
I love that the Horrors same of director? Malformed Man.
I'm trying to look it up.
The guy who did this did a lot. This is the same guy who did Girl Boss Gorilla. It's the same guy who did all the Sex and the Fury films. This guy made like hundreds of Pinky films. So I don't know if it's the same as Horrors of Malformed Man. Because
that's a really great movie.
I loved Horrors of Malformed Man.
Different guy. Same kind of company.
5 second version. Horrors of Malformed Men is kind of about a girl who goes to a mysterious island and discovers all these deformed people. It's got a lot of Hiroshima overtones to it. It's really kind of a horror film answer to The Atomic Bomb. Really well done, but definitely considered an exploitation film still.
Huh. All right, Ryan, hit us with something that's not
subgenre.
I'm trying to think of something with a lot of sexy time. What are those what are those Italian zombie movies that are more that are basically straight up porn?
Those are the Joe D'Amato films.
Yeah. Let's talk about those, because when I watch those, I feel like I'm gonna get crabs.
Wait, those ones are so skanky.
That's the one we talked about earlier.
So the ones that I've seen are like Papaya, Love Goddess of the Cannibals. He's got a couple.
There's like Oasis or something like that.
Porno Holocaust is another one.
So these are just pretty much straight up zombie films, and they're all really boring zombie films, and then somebody will casually have sex.
That's a lot of vigorous sex.
Yeah, and it's
Did they ever have sex with zombies? I don't think I've seen that.
Porno Holocaust. And it's never well filmed. Like, it's neither zombie movie nor a good porno.
There's a lot of gnarly photography.
Yeah, these are not good looking people either. It's not like these are not polished.
Guess they won't come on our show either.
You can just see the syphilis dripping off of your privates.
Yeah, those films I remembered
which brings me to Hexploitation.
I mean, that cover.
Oh, wow.
Oh my.
Holy shit.
I just brought up the porno Holocaust cover.
Don't worry, guys. We'll Instagram this. Oh my.
That's a zombie.
Ernie can't take this one. You know, you ask about my favorite exploitation, and it's a fine balance between Canucksploitation and Carsploitation.
Hey.
At the top of mine, easily with the bullets, Canucksploitation.
Canucksploitation.
Because it's like a bag of I don't know what I'm going to get, but all of it's kind of fun.
And it all feels very genuine and sincere, you know, and it's done with an element of craft. Like, it's not just a bunch of hacks just trying to do a slasher movie or not emulated.
They don't feel as much like they were just made for a drive-in circuit. They feel a little bigger ambition, but with no one watching.
But also,
so these are all the Canadian horror movies that came in like the early
80s. Tax Shelter, Terror Train, Prom Night.
Technically, Ilsa is also a Canuck one.
So. Happy Birthday to Me, Shivers, Death Dream.
Oh wow! Yeah.
There's so many that I love from that period.
Yeah. But I mean, like I said, I love the sincerity. I love the craft. I love how regional they feel. Mm-hmm. You know, My Bloody Valentine, I love just hanging with those characters because they have such sweet accents and they're all really nice. And they like to drink beer. And it's like, yeah, I want to hang out with you guys. And that's what carries you through My Bloody Valentine is your love for these characters. Same with Terror Train, you know. Terror Train just has like I want to live on that train and hang out and then, you know, be brutally murdered.
Or hang out with David Copperfield.
Curtains to me is very atmospheric, and it feels like it's, you know, it's like
one half of it is.
Less the theater parts, but it's true. Like, you could remake just the ice skating scene and make a whole movie around that because that's a good looking horror icon, you know.
And then on the flip side, Carsploitation, you know, one of my favorite. I mean, I talked about Wheels of Terror in this episode. That was a newbie to this you know, the subgenre, but my reigning favorite is the car. The 77 James Brolin movie.
Maximum Overdrive, baby.
Yeah, Maximum Overdrive. The car just has just like a lot of just great moments of menace, and the car design rocks, and James Brolin's rad, and you know, it's just like, again, small town being preyed upon by an unknown force. Right. And it's basically Jaws on land.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. I was going to say, it's totally a Jaws knockoff with a car.
And Futurama was wise enough to rip it off at one point when Bender turned into the car. It was so good.
Yeah, the wear car.
The wear car.
And Guillermo has the car now, and he drives it every Sunday, apparently. Only on Sundays.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a true story. He takes it out on Sundays, Guillermo del Toro.
I want to go find.
I don't know. He owns it.
He lives deep.
I think. I don't know if he owns the original or if he like built it to the specs, but it looks exactly like the car. Yeah.
That's his Sunday thing. He takes the car.
That's what I hear.
But yeah, I mean, there's you know, the film's like, you know, like you said, Maximum Overdrive is probably my second fave.
Yeah.
Vanishing Point. I mean, but that's like one of my favorite films ever, not even just in the car exploitation subgenre. Like, I love that movie.
I love, I'm channeling going back to Connexploitation. I love because it is a bag of like God knows what you're going to get. But I think Deathstream, I think, is like a flat out masterpiece.
That's the Bob Clark movie.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, I mean, you know, obviously Black Christmas also comes from this too. I mean, a lot of it, this comes from tax shelters. A lot of the best movies we all love comes from weird countries' tax shelter systems like Australia, New Zealand. But the two, I've talked about them in a lot. I've overly talked about The Pit, of course, just for pure bonkers fun. But the one I really would always tell people they got to see is Pin. Like, Pin is my favorite of all like psycho spin-offs of what is basically taken from the psycho kind of legend and myth and story. I think Pin is a classy little gem of a movie. So if you haven't seen, I did do a projection booth on it once, way in depth, so I won't waste too much time here, but it's just a really great little movie. I don't think the director did much else besides that, but it's got our stepfather,
Terry Quinn
as the doctor, start talking to a plastic medical mannequin that, you know, comes to life in quote marks, at least in the mind of his son after he's gone. And it's a really creepy, effective little movie. So can exploitation is different than a lot of these because it's not like a word you can say and instantly see it in your head. Right. I say blaxploitation and you pretty much get a sense of what kind of film it is, even though some films buck that trend in an interesting way.
Yeah.
I think that's another one. You know, it's like you've got a movie like Ganja and Hess, which is classy as fuck and like really artistic, but most of the films in there are just like the Blacklist are good movies that are just ripping off other things.
I have one of those, so I will hop in.
Yeah, I have one
here.
Too. You hop in.
Okay, so I included Disco Godfather from 1979, also known as The Avenging Disco Godfather from 1979. This is the one when people talk about blaxploitation that I'm always like, okay, you need to stop and go watch Disco Godfather. This is Rudy Ray Moore, who we discussed recently on the show when we discussed Petey Wheatstraw. But this is kind of their other, I won't call this a horror film, but I will say it's got a lot of horrific imagery in it. So Rudy Ray Moore plays a retired cop who runs a disco, and they're having this crazy PCP problem in his neighborhood, angel dust, as they call it in the movie. And so he, as a retired cop who's running a disco, goes on a crazy rage rampage to try to rid the world of PCP, fighting the dealers and the junkies and everybody who's involved and the manufacturers. And it's amazing because you've got this crazy disco, like shiny scene. There is so much roller skating in this movie. It's like Xanadu. So much roller skating. So you've got this crazy disco stuff with all of this great music and dancing and everything. And then they cross cut it with all of this horribly trippy PCP nightmarish imagery. Because in the movie, people will get trapped in these PCP nightmares, and that's how Rudy Ray Moore gets involved, is these people like are taking this horrible PCP and they get trapped and they can't get back out. And so he's trying to stop it. He's trying to attack the whack, is his phrase in the movie. And so you're getting this like crazy, trippy, like surrealist imagery intermixed with a lot of disco. And he says the phrase, put your weight on it, put your weight on it, which repeatedly. And I think that means like you're supposed to dance, because I'm not hip enough to get this. He says it at the disco, like put your weight on it. But then it comes to also seem to recognize him putting his weight on the criminal activity. I say in the most unhip way possible. So
white Becca,
put your weight on it. Put your weight on it.
Excuse me, sir. Could you please put your weight on it?
Please put your weight onto this. It's also Keith David's first film, which is pretty funny.
Hey.
So, yeah. He's really quick. He's in the disco. Disco, but yeah, you definitely watch it. You go, hey, that was Keith David.
That's cool.
As we circle out of Blaxploitation, I just want to throw a title as we go to Rob. It's coming out soon, and it's really good, and Elijah Drenner has worked on it. He tells me it's like one of the best releases he's worked on, is JD's Revenge, which is the detective ghost story, but he says this release is just gorgeous and have great extras. So look out for that one. It's a ghost PI nice. Blaxploitation fun, and I remember really liking it when I started a long time ago, so I'm excited to revisit that one.
And Disco Godfather is just got a Fancy Schmance release a couple of months, maybe a year ago, from Vinegar Syndrome.
That's right. Yeah. Well, my next title is one that I share with Elric.
I've got it on my list.
I love ripoffs that literally films that are exploiting other films. And the most bonkers one you'll ever see is this Indonesian movie called Lady Terminator.
Yeah, it's so cool. And with an Australian lead actress.
First she mates, then she terminates. Yeah. And my memory is it's actually like a mashup of several 80s movies, if I'm not mistaken. It's been a while since I've seen this one.
Yeah, it has some Terminator stuff, but then also some weird like serial killer stuff and then weird worshipping things, the weird ceremonial stuff at the start.
Isn't she like a black some man. Sort of princess or some sort of
totally.
Weird
it's like
story.
A lot of stuff flung against a wall.
It is.
But it's fun.
Yeah, that's the thing. It is fun, and it's just kind of crazy, and you can't believe that people made this thing.
Yeah, you really can't. It's so bizarre.
But Lady Terminator, that's my next one.
Nice.
I threw in just because Italian cannibal movies fascinate me, and even though I can't just go, hey,
Porno Holocaust? I know.
Porno Holocaust, yeah. This one does not have penetration, but it has John Saxon. It's called Cannibal Apocalypse.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a post-Vietnam PTSD allegory about a bunch of war vets come back from the war, and then they've got cannibalistic tendencies, like a virus. And while I don't remember a lot about it, I remember it stuck with me because there is like some sort of weird John Saxon maybe having an affair with a neighbor. It could be completely wrong, but I just remember just like being a movie like called Cannibal Apocalypse definitely sets itself apart from Cannibal Ferox, Cannibal Holocaust, mm-hmm. by just being on home soil. It's actually set in America. So it's just about these war vets that come home, bringing with them something from overseas. It's a weird little movie. I would just recommend checking it out at least once. It's, you know, it carries all the benchmarks of all those cannibal movies. Very violent, very strange logic. But you get John Saxon. So check it out.
Nice.
And the soundtrack's available from Death Waltz Records. So
that is
pretty
correct.
Darn good.
Yeah. Let's see. Basically the king of exploitation, in my opinion, would be Roger Corman. Mm-hmm. And several years back, Shout Factory did a whole series of before there was a Scream Factory, they did a whole series of Roger Corman cult classics.
Oh yeah.
And I was very fortunate that I got to work on a lot of these, and that was kind of the first time I saw a lot of these films. So I'm going to recommend a trio just because they all kind of fit together, and it's a lot of the same people that worked on them. Hence, I worked on all three simultaneously, and that's Galaxy of Terror, Forbidden World, and Battle Beyond the Stars.
Oh, this is called Spaceploitation.
Pretty
I've
much,
heard
yes.
it called that.
Yeah. And the first two were more horror movies than Battle Beyond the Stars. That Battle Beyond the Stars is more just a Star Wars knockoff, mm-hmm. and not that great one. But the stories behind how these were made and the ambition behind it. I mean, literally, I think James Cameron was helping prop assistant on Galaxy of Terror. And by the end of the third movie they were working on, he was already set to direct something for them. Like his evolution. And, the story that I always remember is, like, I think it was on Forbidden World. He just kept telling everybody that he was working. It's like, why aren't you trying to make a movie as good as Alien? Like, we should be trying to make, like, Alien. Alien's, like, the best movie right now, and we should be trying to make something just as good. And nobody understood how passionate his vision – like, nobody, like, it's just a little movie, blah, blah, blah. And that's why it's ironic that he just went to do Aliens, because like, why aren't we making a movie like Alien? Fuck it. I'm going to go and make Aliens.
And I think Corman did see it, right? Like, Corman went in there late one night and saw what he was doing. It was like, oh, shit, this guy actually – and I think one of the things he got was, like, he went to McDonald's and just got the Big Mac kind of thing.
Well, they needed to decorate the inside of a spaceship, and they had no money. And so at that time, McDonald's served styrofoam things. things. Yeah. So he went and bought like 100 burgers just so he can get the styrofoam cups, and he put them all up, and that is the set in Galaxy of Terror. It's all McDonald's.
No one lean against the set. It's going to make sounds.
Yeah. But then I think Corman was like, this kid's on another level if he's thinking to go to McDonald's and making me a set that looks like an actual spaceship now. Huh. So
that's awesome.
I have a Corman film as well, so I'll jump in. This is one of my favorite movies ever, and I struggled to call it an exploitation film, but when it came out, that's what it was truly considered to be, and that is 1959's Bucket of Blood.
That's a trend starter.
Yeah, I consider this to be, this is a trend starter, and it was considered to be an exploitation film. It was like cheap drive-in fare. Yeah. And I consider this to be one of Corman's best films ever, just because it is so kind of still topical today and really topical at the time. He co-wrote this or co-created it with Charles Griffiths, and apparently they just were hanging out at beatnik coffee shops around LA and said, these people are really annoying, let's make a movie about them, and just kind of combined it with the Mysteries of the Wax Museum from the 1930s. And boom, they had Bucket of Blood starring Dick Miller. So obviously trendsetting in that regard as well. Dick Miller plays a struggling artist who can't find a way to kind of fit in with the highbrow art crowd. And they're horrible people. So you spend much of the movie going, why would you want to fit in with these people? And he eventually kills his neighbor's cat, kind of turns it into a statue. And then everybody loves the statue. So he goes, I wonder if I can do this with more dead things. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it escalates from there.
It's Beat Generation. That's the interesting thing. It's the last you really get of that generation on film some weird way. Because then it becomes Herschel Gordon Lewis stuff after that.
Yeah, they are full in like berets and black turtlenecks. Yeah. And it's like full beatniks. This kicked off their kind of horror comedy crossovers. Like they followed this up with Little Shop of Horrors and then Creature from the Haunted Sea. But this kind of opened the door for a lot of the horror comedies to come in the 1960s, which we do know more as exploitation. Things like Herschel Gordon Lewis's, the 2000 Maniacs and things like that, where it really is intentionally blending horror and comedy together, getting more gruesome as it goes to see how far they can push it. So this was kind of like one of the first ones to open that gateway.
My favorite Corman stuff, I mean, of that in terms of what we're talking about, is Woman in Prison films, hands down. I'm weird. I'm not that into like pinky and porn. Porn is porn to me, whereas with movies I don't necessarily like enjoy watching that weird crossover because it maybe takes me out or something. But Woman in Prison, I still like to look at people who are gorgeous, like Pam Grier in prison movies, and I just think the Jack Hill films that he made, Big Dollhouse and Big Birdcage, are just dynamite.
Elric just so wants to see his protagonist in chains or behind bars.
The girls in these movies are the ones kicking the ass. The wardens are the ones who get their comeuppance.
I will say, like, there's nothing sexy about a lot of these films because they are so kind of brutal and tough at the same time.
Yeah,
and Sid Haig's in all of them with them. They're a lot of fun. So if you need to see them, I highly recommend those.
Now, have you ever seen Temptation Island? It's not called Temptation
Island.
Terminal Island.
Favorite
Thank
TV
you.
Shows.
Yeah, no. Forget that. Terminal Island, Stephanie Rothman film. Uh-huh. I love that one. It's about an island where they put criminals.
Is Tom Selleck in it?
I think he is, actually, now that I'm remembering.
Yeah, I don't
he
think
may
I've
be.
Seen it, but I think I've heard of him.
I remember really liking I was shown that in a film class in grad school, and it was one of those things where you're like, why is he watching this? Or why are we watching this? And I really liked that one. So, but I have one more title. For my last one, I wanted to go with something that people may not have heard of that isn't as well known as something as like Bucket of Blood. So I went with The Plumber. Yeah. From 1979, which I know Elric's heard of because we've had conversations about this. Yeah.
Legit mainstream director.
Yeah. Peter Weir, who goes on to direct amazing stuff. And The Plumber's pretty amazing, too.
Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Yeah. Last Wave, Cars That Ate Paris. Yeah. Like, he has a lot of really good stuff. So this one, I'll say it's not like 100% horror. I'll call it more tense the whole time. It is about a woman and her husband, and they're both, I think he's a professor and she is like a graduate researcher, and they both portray them as being kind of like highbrow academics, and they are in an apartment and they have a plumbing problem, something busts, and so they call this plumber. And the guy shows up and he's like, oh, this is a big mess. I'm going to have to like really rip some things out to fix this. And he starts fixing it. And so for days, this guy is just hanging around. And her husband is off working, so she's home with him the majority of the time that he's there. And she becomes really paranoid. Like, she swears he's watching her, and he's looking at her. And then she thinks that things are going missing, like he's taking things of hers. And in the meantime, you don't know if this guy is actually doing sinister stuff, because he is kind of like, well, this is wrong now. Now I have to fix this. And you don't know if he's actually like got really sinister motives, if there is something wrong with the plumbing, or if he's just a shitty plumber and it takes him a really long time to fix this stuff. He himself seems to be kind of just bumbling and oafish, but at the same time, you can't tell if that's like him playing coy and actually having sinister motives about it.
That's just Australians.
Yeah, yeah, that's just Australians
that's
in general.
That's how they all come off.
You never know. It is, in the majority of the film, and this should not make it sound boring in any way, is just the plumber and the woman in the apartment. And somehow it is so tense. And I mean, just the way that Peter Weir crafts the ambiguity of what's going on and not knowing, and is it in her head or is it actually happening? It's ingenious. And this film got rather disregarded. It didn't get much of a release over here. It still hasn't had much of a release over here. So yeah, it's one, if you were just looking for just a really tight, tense little film, I highly recommend Peter Weir's 1979, The Plumber.
If you're a big catsploitation film,
catsploitation.
After my soaring love of Night of a Thousand Cats, then let me just point you to a little film by Ted V. Meekles called The Corpse Grinders.
Oh,
because I'd forgotten, man. It's an awful little movie, but I'd forgotten that it also has the cats eating people because they get a taste for them.
Yep.
Because they're feeding them.
Oh,
the
I
grinders.
Find that gross. Every time I see the trailers when I'm in
a
theater. Yeah.
I saw it in theaters once at some like all-nighter, and I remember just going, oh, this is a nasty film. But, you know, if you like your catsploitation, I can't stop you.
Catsploitation.
I'm giving you a new one. I'm just going to throw out movies to remind you. This is my favorite of all exploitation ripoff movies ever. The reason I'm bringing it up again, I won't go into details, Rituals, because it's getting the big Blu-ray release finally after much harassment of Code Red. And this is the Hal Holbrook Deliverance ripoff.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of my favorite movies. I just love this movie. So I think it's coming out soonish. I'm not sure if they ever announced a date, but I've seen the cover art and everything. So look to Scorpion for that, because that's also Canucksploitation, because it was made up there. But it's a really great movie.
Wow. Nice. All right, that sounds great. Yeah, I mean, the last thing I wanted to mention basically was, and it kind of ties into the Corman titles that I started to recommend, is it's funny when a film becomes so successful that then you have a whole subgenre of exploitation based on it. And Stephen Scarlotta, our friend who produced Jodorowsky's Dune and co-wrote Beyond the Gates, he wrote an article for Blumhouse.com all on alien ripoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically, Alien became such a big thing. And again, some of this, the Corman stuff I brought up is falls in that vein. But I neglected to mention to our listener and supporter, Dennis Atherton, that I had seen Extra on the screen a few weeks ago.
So lucky.
And that, I think, falls in the alien ripoff / exploitation. I got to tell you, NewBev crowd at midnight, no one knew it hit them. Usually they always ask, like, how many people have seen this? And Phil Blankenship hosted it. Yeah. So he's like, this is gross and slimy and you are in for it. Just wait. And sure enough, it was. And but it just reminded me of those type of films. And there's a couple. I mean, obviously, I mentioned Forbidden World before.
Contamination falls
Contamination.
Into that.
Creature, which is actually Titan Fine. And that's William Malone's first
Klaus
film
Kinski
from the – yeah, with Klaus Kinski from 1985. Scarlotta picked Captain EO from the Michael Jackson.
Oh, wow. Is that an alien ripoff? I remember that as a kid's film and a Disney ride.
Well, because Angelica Houston looks like a Geiger creature.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
So, yeah. It was directed by Francis Ford Coppola and written by George Lucas.
And it's got Michael Jackson in it,
with
right?
For Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
And basically they used elements from all those things. So that's kind of hilarious.
I went to Epcot when I was a kid and they were doing a huge Captain EO push. And I got this like little monkey with a long tail that was stuffed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
In the movie. And I don't know if I ever actually saw the movie. I just remember the whole Epcot thing around it.
Yeah. And apparently Fred Olen Ray did a couple. He did one called Deep Space in 1988.
Mm.
So that's kind of crazy. And Biohazard in 1985. So yeah, so there's a lot of, if you want to go into the alien ripoff stuff, there's one that Shout Factory put out as a double bill, and I lost it. Let me see if I can find the link again. But basically it was from the Corman collection, and I'd never seen either of them.
There's one of the Corman space films where the actor is dubbed with a British accent. And I can't even remember which one it is, but it was so Corman when I was watching it, where the actor's speaking and you're like, I've heard that actor speak before, but he was dubbed with a very classy British accent. So.
It's The Terror Within and Deep Space. They put out a double bill of this, and I'm curious if anyone out there has ever seen these, because I never have, but I always remember that cover art for both of them.
Terror Within, I've seen that cover. I haven't seen the other one.
Yeah, Deep Space. Dead Space. So a lot of fun stuff.
Yeah. No one mentioned any animal exploitation or nature.
Cat exploitation.
I guess, but those like the
animals run amok.
Yeah, I feel like animal attacks is like a different exploitation.
I don't even feel like they're exploitation. I feel like that's its own subgenre.
It is.
Animal attack movies.
Yeah. It totally is.
Yeah, that's a Ryan subject to get to at some point. Yeah. All right.
I mean, this is the kind of thing we could talk for hours. So there's so many titles, but you know, we've been doing it for a month. So
yeah. Exploitation month is slowly coming to
slowly grinding to a halt.
So thanks for listening, and give us your favorite subgenres. Yeah.
Slide them on in,
and let us know the best movie in that subgenre.
Yep. And check out American Grindhouse. Good little taster for this.
Indeed. Definitely.
Perfect. All right. See you next week.
See you next week.